March 14th, 2018. This is CCWP on ICANN and Human Rights, room 103B. It is 8:30 in the morning.
Hi, Vidushi. This is Julie in the meeting room. Would you be able to test your line for us, please? If you could just say
hi,
something.
Hi, this is Vidushi.
Oh, perfect. Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us this morning. I think we're going to give it just another minute to allow people to come in. I'm going to go dance in the lobby for a second, get people in the room. But we'll just give it a couple minutes, and then we'll get started. All right. So I think that we can go ahead and get started in the interest of time, because I know that there are a lot of competing sessions. So if we can move through our packed agenda and have some time left over, then we can all go see the GDPR session. Is there a recording?
There is.
Okay. All right, great. So I am Colin Curry. I'm from Article 19, and I am co-chair of the Cross-Community Working Party on ICANN and Human Rights with Michael Karaniklis. Mike, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Michael Karaniklis. I'm Colin's co-chair. I'm on the NCUC. And thanks very much to everyone for joining us.
Great. So could we put up the slideshow, the slide deck? Yeah, for us. So this is a special meeting for the CCWP. If, in case you haven't realized, we've got two new chairs. Niels Tenover, who has served us so well and is actually connecting remotely, stepped down at the last meeting, so Michael and I have taken over the CCWP. In addition, this is the 10th ICANN meeting since the CCWP HR was chartered, so we've done a lot in those 10 ICANNs. Could we go to the next slide, please? Here, I'm just going to click this. There we go. So this is one of our most recognizable works, perhaps, this process mapping, or this mapping all of the human rights that are impacted by ICANN policies. I know it's a bit small as it appears on the screen, so if you'd like to see it, it's on the internet, or I have plenty of PDF copies on my computer, so I'd be happy to send it to you. So the CCWP, could we go to the next slide? There we go. So the CCWP was chartered to do many things. It is a chartered organization of the NCSG, and it is intended to map the human rights effects of ICANN policies, procedures, and operations, like the infographic that you saw before, to provide a forum for related discussions about human rights in the ICANN context, to research better ways to harmonize ICANN's policies and procedures, and to provide information, suggestions, or recommendation to SOs, ACs, and the broader communities, and then potentially to propose procedures or mechanisms on how these SOs and ACs, these chartering organizations, might be able to fulfill the human rights bylaw. So let's go to the next slide. So in addition to this beautiful infographic, we've had many other papers and things that we have put forth for the ICANN community's consideration. So this first one at the top was in 2014. That was launched right when the CCWP was chartered, and it was written by two authors and partner. I think that it was commissioned by the Council of Europe. Since then, we have tried to do a deep dive into how either specific ICANN processes or specific rights impact one another. And then at the last meeting in Abu Dhabi, we presented an initial sketch for how a human rights impact assessment model might be incorporated into GNSO PDPs. And there we used the Zorro process map and tried to identify potential areas where an impact assessment could be inserted, and then the types of questions or considerations that might be considered in doing so. So if we could go to next slide, we have a special guest joining us today, Ergis Ramaj. Am I saying that right?
No, it's Ergis Ramaj. Close enough, though.
Ergis Ramaj. Oh, well. So he has his own slide deck. I don't want to step on his toes. So maybe if we could go to him, because I know you don't have very much time. He's going to tell us about ICANN organization and the ongoing human rights impact assessment they are carrying out.
Thank you, Colin, and good morning, everyone. Thanks again for the opportunity to address the group today. I have prepared a couple of slides, but I will go very quickly through them, and hopefully we can engage in a discussion. I can answer any questions that you or anyone around the table or the room may have. Just a little bit of background before I get into the details of this. Could you please go back one slide, please? Yeah, just here. About a year and a half ago, within ICANN.org, we got together to discuss the possibility of carrying out the internal human rights impact assessment as it relates to ICANN.org conducting its daily business operations. And at the time, we had concluded that this is a good thing to do for the organization. It is the right thing to do, and it is a proactive thing to do. It is not just a risk mitigation exercise, but it's also an opportunity for us to improve and enhance our business operations. Fast forward to about 6 months ago, in October, we had issued an open call for a request for proposals, which was answered by seven individual entities. And after going through that process, we had identified and selected Loaning for Business and Human Rights, which is a Berlin, Germany-based consultancy that is spearheaded by Marcus Loaning, who is the former Germany's former human rights leader. Next slide, please. So what I would like to make very clear in this discussion is essentially the difference between what we're doing on the org side and what the community is doing primarily through Workstream 2 in developing the framework of interpretation for human rights as it relates to the core value in the new ICANN bylaws. The human rights impact assessment that I am discussing today is strictly limited to ICANN, the organization conducting daily business operations. It does not touch on the policy development process that the ICANN community is currently involved in taking a closer look at. So I think this distinction needs to be made very, very clear. Essentially, this is, as I mentioned earlier, just a benchmarking exercise. A lot of organizations and corporations are engaged in carrying out internal human rights impact assessment, and ICANN is now engaged in its very first one. Next slide, please. So in terms of the scope, and I apologize for not introducing Betsy Andrews before, she's on my team, and Betsy and I work very closely together, will be working very closely together on this exercise. We were in Germany about 2 weeks ago, where we had our initial kickoff meeting with Marcus and his team, and this is when we decided on the scope, and essentially there will be four areas of focus. The first one will be human resources, the second one will be procurement, and of course, in no particular order, event planning, as well as the implications of running worldwide offices. I'm more than happy to provide some potential examples of what each one of these may include a little later as we engage in a discussion. Next slide, please. And this is the last slide for me. Just a rough timeline here. I mentioned that Betsy and I were in Germany a couple of weeks ago. In the next 2 weeks, we have started the collection of documentation. Marcus and his team are taking a look at the documents that we have provided. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, there will be in-person interviews with the leadership from the ICANN org side that oversees the four focus areas that I mentioned earlier, as well as individuals who work on their team. Bottom line is we expect the final report to be ready sometime around the end of this summer, so around August. And, of course, at that point, we will make some of the recommendations publicly available. And when I say some, I mean some, not all of them, because there may be information in there that's that the ICANN organization may not be able to share because of privacy concerns. So that concludes my very brief presentation, and I'm more than happy to engage with anyone and answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Have we got any questions from any of our participants? And you guys sitting in the back, feel free to grab a spot at the table. Yes, David.
Thank you. My name is David McCauley. I'm with VeriSign. And new to this working party, but fresh from CCWG Accountability Workstream 2 Human Rights Subgroup. And so my question touches on this. It's a budget question. Is this effort touch both fiscal year 18 and 19 budgets, and are the contracts, how are they funded? Is it a fixed price contract?
Yes, it's a fixed price contract, and all of the funds will come from FY18.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Per-Åke Wixell from the same country as Göran Morby, Sweden. I'm from the Swedish police. I'm an old and gray hair man, so excuse me for using my question here. I will tell you that I represent 28 different law enforcement countries from all Europe fighting against child abuse on the internet. As you know, internet is a place where all young people of today gathers. More and more our children use cell phones and connect as soon as they wake up. Unfortunately, some kids don't want to wake up, and some of them don't wake up. We think that up to 3% of the population, the male population, are predators who are interested in sexual abuse against children. When I say children, I mean kids from as young as 1 day old up to 18. So human rights forms also is a question for children. And my question is the human rights of the children taken into account here in this project? You know, the Child Convention is quite clear, every country in the world except USA, I think, and one more country have signed this convention. And I would be really happy if you, and I quite suppose that you talk about children's rights here as well. So it's just a former question.
I didn't catch your name. Could you?
Per-Åke Wexell.
Okay. Tijani, did you want to respond to that?
Thank you very much. I would like to ask you, Tijani speaking, I would like to ask you, how do you see this issue of child abuse can be addressed here in ICANN?
I think this is could be the place, because you have make the plan here, or just talking about this issue in the different sessions of ICANN, because you know, the predators use the internet, they use the different web pages, URLs, the domain names, and so on. I know that ICANN is not responsible, has no responsibility for what's in the context, or what you call it, but we have also the internet service providers helping us. We have the bank, the financial helping us. So why not the ones who are driving the internet?
Would you like to comment, Holly?
Holly Rage for the transcript. First, I'd like to point out that, in fact, if you look at your timeline, globally that's incorrect, because August for us is winter. So please be a little bit careful and respect the fact that some of us actually live on the other side of the globe. That said, just to clarify, I think this is about human rights in the ICANN.org context, not human rights in terms of the output, which would be working groups and policies. So I'd be interested to know, in the org context, if any of those issues arise. I think I'd be a little bit surprised if that were the case. Thank you.
May I respond to that? Eric Gisrama, for the record. You are correct. This exercise does not touch on any of the work that the community is doing on the policy side. And I apologize for the summer there. We will make sure to correct that moving forward.
I just want to say that I'm really excited that this session has kicked off with such a lively exchange. We will be speaking a bit later about how to incorporate impact assessments based on internationally recognized human rights law into the different policy development processes, but that's going to be a little bit later in the session. So maybe we can just put this conversation on hold for a little bit and move forward. Does anybody else have any questions about the human rights impact assessment that ICANN, the organization, is carrying out? Yes, David.
Thank you. One request, David McCauley speaking again. One request, and one question. The request is, can those brief slides be made available, or are they available on the wiki?
This is Aaron. I'm from staff. All the slides are already uploaded to the ICANN61 schedule page, so you can check the PDF links on the site.
Thank you very much. And so the question is, taking the point that this is an exercise having to do with ICANN.org, what will happen with, what does it mean to communicate results? Communicate them to whom? Like, will the community get involved in this at all, or?
Yes, absolutely. This is Ericus for the record again. When we publish the final report, we mean to the community. And what this will be is a set of recommendations in priority order based on what Marcus and his team will, after they conduct all the analysis, and this will be reflecting their findings, and it will be in priority order.
Tijani.
I think Tijani has a...
Okay, Tijani speaking again. I'd like to highlight the fact that we have a mission, ICANN has a mission, and anything that is addressed here should be inside the ICANN mission. We cannot address anything related to the content. Thank you.
So I've actually got a couple questions. Could you tell us, are you at liberty to tell us a bit about your vendor selection process and how you determined which bid was the most appropriate?
We followed standard ICANN procurement practices. I don't know what kinds of details you would like for me to share with you. The way that we conduct our procurement practices are available online. You can take a look at how the process works. What we did, we worked very closely with the head of our procurement. We designed the criteria that we were going to follow, and then we conducted the interviews with all of the vendors, and then we determined which one was the most appropriate one based on the needs that we'd identified.
So my thinking behind that question was, I was wondering, I would imagine that perhaps different vendors would approach assessing human rights impacts with using different methodologies. So I wondered if that was something that played into your selection criteria, or if it was just more standard procurement procedures.
Yeah, so you'd be surprised to know that I would say, by and large, all seven of those who bid on this particular opportunity used or referenced the same mechanisms and instruments. The internationally recognized human rights instruments that are out there. It was pretty much uniform.
So are there any plans to share the methodology that is used to assess the impact afterwards?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any other questions, comments? Are there any questions from our remote participants? Okay, it appears that there are not, so maybe we can move on to our next agenda item. So if we could go back to the... let's go to the next slide. So thank you very much for giving that presentation. So human rights are obviously very important, and ICANN, or the organization, is taking an active step in recognizing this. But there's a bit of a story behind ICANN organization's human rights impact assessment, and it all starts with a bylaw. So if we could go to the next slide, please. This is the ICANN human rights core value, which is a part of the bylaws that kind of govern the organization. You can see here I've highlighted what I think is the most relevant part. It is that ICANN will respect internationally recognized human rights as required by applicable law. And then you can see that the rest of the text obviously puts a bit of a condition on this and saying that within the scope of its mission, and it does not obligate ICANN to enforce human rights obligations on contracted parties, for example, or other actors. If we could go to the next slide. So when this bylaw was implemented at the same exact time, another bylaw came into effect, the interim human rights core value, which says that the human rights bylaw that we saw before would not have force or effect unless or until a framework of interpretation for deciphering what exactly was meant by that law, bylaw had been developed. And this was the mandate that was given to a particular subgroup of the cross-community working group on ICANN's accountability. So I think I'm going to turn to my co-chair to review what's going on in Workstream 2.
Thanks so much for that. And we have, I think, some members of the group, of the human rights group, who were already working on this in Workstream 2, who are active in the human rights group, as well as rapporteurs from other groups, who I'm sure will correct me if and when I inevitably make a mistake. So as the slide up there indicates, there were several different sub-themes for Workstream 2. We have, as of Friday, gotten to the point where each of those work streams has now finished their draft report, and it's going to be presented to the community for commentary. The commentary upcoming is mainly meant to be focused on inconsistencies or overlap between the different subgroup recommendations, as opposed to the substance of the individual reporting, which is because there were so many opportunities to comment previously. So even though the Workstream 2 work is still ongoing, the reports that you're seeing there on each different issue, including human rights, are pretty much close to being finalized. And once the community has approved it, we'll go to the to the board for their own approval. Can we get the next slide, please? So in terms of the human rights subgroup in particular, the important output that's there is the framework of interpretation. Yeah, sure.
So we do have, I think, maybe some people who were either participating or observing in the human rights subgroup. The human rights subgroup finished its work actually in October, which was very exciting. And it was really a very much a bottom-up, multi-stakeholder-driven document that we have at the end. There were a lot of exchanges, sometimes heated, but the final product is something that I think is quite agreeable to everyone. And as you can see, it took quite some time. Even though we finished early, there were 32 meetings and 816 hours on calls. So it's a lot of time. And then you can see in our little flow chart here, where we are in this graphic is that we're kind of right there at the end of the human rights subgroup. And then you see the framework of interpretation being the product of that. And then this is kind of dictating how it should or shouldn't be applied to the different SOs and ACs, which are in the little circles below. Do you want
to? So as part of the framework of interpretation, it presents it's up to each SO and AC, as well as the individual PDPs, to develop their own policies and frameworks to fulfill that core value that's in the bylaws now, or will be in the bylaws later this year. There was no consensus reached within the working group as to a single standard to draw on for carrying out these human rights impact assessments. There was a lot of back and forth around the UN guiding principles. Obviously, the UN guiding principles are can be a useful guide if the different SOs or ACs consider that to be the case. But fundamentally, it's up to the individual groups to decide how to carry out the human rights impact assessments, what standards should be informing this decision-making process, and fundamentally which values to draw on and should inform their thinking, particularly with regards to the different PDPs. So I think that that's probably about it for that. We can, with that sort of introduction, I know that there are a lot of people here from different SOs and ACs, from different stakeholder groups, from different interests. And so given that we are going to have in front of us an interesting challenge going forward in terms of how to carry out, implement this human rights bylaw, I thought it would be very useful to open up and try to foster a conversation of different approaches that people might consider, particularly in consideration of the FOI that's been passed. What are some thoughts as to how that can be applied by the different SOs and ACs, maybe either as a broad statement or from the perspective of a single individual SOAC or even a PDP? What are some considerations? What are some procedural ideas? What are some values that should inform this decision-making? Sorry, did you want to...
David, did you want to make a comment?
Thanks. David McCauley speaking again. I just wanted to go back one point and make an addendum to what Michael's summary was of the CCWG accountability. I thought it was a great summary, but I just want to make a brief addendum that will then be relevant to the next point of implementing the human rights bylaw. And the addendum would simply be that Friday, the group took the decision, by the way, parenthetically, I should say that CCWG for accountability ends at the end of June this year, at the end of the fiscal year, and there are no funds for that group to work as a group in the next fiscal year. And that ICANN 62 in Panama is when the final report will basically be done and dusted and handed off to the COs and the board. In any event, the group on Friday took the decision that there will be basically what amounts to a standing group of people to help in interpretation. And that standing group will be the co-chairs of the CCWG and accountability, together with the rapporteurs for each of the subgroups. And so there will be some expert help available in the future for interpreting, for helping the board and the community interpret what was meant by this long report that's going to come out. And so I just thought I'd say that. And so they'll be available to help. And that would affect, I would assume, the framework of interpretation on human rights. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Thanks for that clarification. And that's actually a really great segue into what we're going to be talking about. So as you said, in the Workstream 2 and in the Human Rights Subgroup, it was really dedicated to interpreting the human rights bylaw. And there were conflicting opinions on how that should be interpreted vis-a-vis the United Nations Guiding Principles or the RUGI Principles. If we could go to the next slide. So here we have just a little overview of the RUGI Principles, and I think that Mike might be able to explain a bit more, but wait just a second. Because I do want to make the clarification that as we kind of transition into talking about implementation rather than interpretation, then the RUGI principles can be interpreted in a different light. It doesn't need to necessarily be interpreted. As we saw in the bylaw, it does not create the obligation for ICANN to, for example, enforce human rights frameworks in its contracted parties or beyond the scope of its mission. However, the framework of interpretation does cite the United Nations Guiding Principles as a potentially useful point of reference, specifically in how it recommends human rights impact assessments for implementation. And again, there we see the clear division between interpreting the bylaw and implementing the bylaw. So, Mike, if you want to give us a little bit of a rundown about the UNGPs.
Sure. So the UNGPs, as indicated in the slide there, are basically predicated on two main principles, namely that the states have a fundamental duty to protect human rights as firmly established under international law, whereas the duty of private sector entities is mainly to respect human rights and to avoid adverse impacts on human rights. If you'll just give me one second to get my presentation. presentation out. Right. So the second impact is obviously more relevant to ICANN's operations as a fundamentally non-state actor. There are two main components to that, as understood in the UN Guiding Principles. One is to avoid causing or contributing to adverse human rights impacts and to seek to address such impacts when they occur. And the other is to seek to prevent or mitigate adverse human rights impacts that are directly linked to their operations, products, or services by their business relationships, even if they've not contributed to those impacts. The main mechanism for these responsibilities is through due diligence in applying these considerations to policymaking processes. That'll typically be done by human rights impact assessments, which considers both actual and potential effects, and which should draw on internal and or independent external human rights expertise and involve meaningful consultation with potentially affected groups. These assessments should be carried out prior to a new activity, prior to a major decision or change in the operation, and periodically through the life of an activity or relationship. And those two fundamental principles sort of lead into the third principle, which alongside the duty of states to protect and the duty of the private sector to respect human rights, is the availability of appropriate remedies where a corporation has caused or contributed to an adverse human rights impact. So that's sort of a Cliff Notes version of the Ruggie principles and the basic outline for how they should be applied in assessing human rights in the private sector.
I think we might have a comment. Kathy, would you like to weigh in? Yes.
Is the microphone on? Yes, Kathy Kleiman. So a question, and maybe we haven't gotten there yet. Where in the ICANN process, say a PDP working group, would a human rights impact assessment take place prior to implementation? Is it after, and let me pose, is it after the PDP working group finishes? Is it during the implementation review team phase? Is it after, because then the policy is already adopted? So I'm the newcomer to the group, so I apologize if this is a well-covered issue.
That is the million-dollar question. That is this enormous challenge that I think faces the community, where we know that there needs to be human rights considerations now baked into these processes as well as applied to these processes. So how do you do that, particularly in there's different contexts where we need to puzzle that through. Presumably, going forward, when a new PDP is set up, there will be, at the very least, a human rights impact assessment baked into it so that there's human rights thinking informing how it's established.
We actually mapped this out at ICANN 60. So, and actually Vidushi did quite a lot of work on this, scoping and mapping the potential areas, particularly in the GNSO policy development process, where these human rights impact assessments or elements of them could be inserted. She's actually joining us remotely, so perhaps we can let her speak to that question since she's done so much research on it.
And a quick hi from Kathy to Vidushi.
Vidushi, can you hear us?
Yes, hi. Hi, everyone, and thanks for that, Colin. I was trying to figure out how to raise my hand through an audio bridge, but thank you for that. So I think this is a really important aspect of the entire human rights discussion, which is how do we actually make human rights part of ICANN policy and procedure in a way that's systemic and organic and not really an afterthought or, you know, something that we look at ex ante. And when, like Colin mentioned, that we presented this model at ICANN 60, the thinking behind that was that we already have these really elaborate procedures for policy development at ICANN, specifically at the GNSO. There's that lovely V-shaped diagram, which I'm sure many of you have seen. And the thinking behind baking in human rights considerations into those development processes is to have a check at the time every at the point of every report being published. So when staff comes out with an initial issue report and a final issue report, we have a check through, and just as an added step to existing procedures. So it's also, it's doable, it's nimble, and it's also something that's very realistic in terms of just going through it from top to bottom through a human rights lens at the time, just before you publish it. And this can be replicated even at the working group stage. It can be published right after the board vote. I'm happy to share the resources and the report that we presented at the last meeting. Maybe I could email it to Mariam right now. But I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Yeah, I've actually just emailed that to her. So that will be available shortly on the ICANN61 event page for this meeting, if you'd like to take a look. So this is something completely different. Now for something completely different. It's not completely different, but I would like to clarify right off the bat that this tool that you are seeing in front of you is an example of a private company that is implementing an HRAA of their own services. It was a CCTLD registry, SIDN, in the Netherlands, and we worked with them since presenting at ICANN 60. We worked very closely with SIDN and then the Danish Institute of Human Rights, which was actually one of the bodies that put forth a proposal to do the HRAA for ICANN, the organization. And we worked with them to begin developing a tool to assess the impacts of provision of services in the DNS space, which is easier said than done because a lot of it is quite... quite esoteric, quite broad, quite hard to nail down into concrete impacts. But we think that we've got a great point of departure in doing that. So I wanted to bring this research, let it to the table, let you know that this is something that we have been working on in parallel to our work at ICANN. And hopefully once we get more SOs and ACs involved in this conversation about implementation and how we're going to move forward, hopefully this is research that will be able to inform these conversations and perhaps serve as a point of departure when we're trying to design specific mechanisms for each SO and AC to comply with the bylaw. So if we could go to the next slide. So now if we can perhaps echo the question that Mike asked earlier, how this implementation is going to happen is a big question mark. We've got ideas, we've got maybe some suggestions, but each SO and AC's decision-making process is unique. So it will be a challenge not only to implement them, but to implement mechanisms that have some level of consistency or some level of interoperability, let's say, between them to ensure that the bylaw is being consistently applied across all of the chartering organizations. So if you have any ideas about how we could move forward, I'd welcome that. But I'd also welcome ideas about challenges, ideas about things that we need to consider or potential barriers that we might face in attempting to proceed with implementation. Yes, Claudio.
Colin, thank you very much. Claudio Lucena, for the record. Are you directly involved with the previous initiative in the Netherlands? Are you the one working with them? Because I was wondering if you could, for example, pick up one example of an issue that you thought it was a bit more concrete and objective, and one other that you thought was a little bit more challenging in terms of the abstract nature of it, so that we can see pretty much where we're going here, or gauge at least the challenges that are ahead. If it's something that comes to your mind easily.
Well, one thing that comes to just off the top of my head, and this is a very comprehensive spreadsheet. Actually, David, you've seen it. You can confirm that it is very long. It is very detail-oriented. But just off the top of my head, for example, trying to assess the impact, as in number of people impacted, on, for example, a domain, seizing a domain or shutting down a domain or denying domain services to a certain registrant for XYZ reason, that was quite difficult to say how many in standard human rights impact assessments. If you're talking about drilling a well or you're talking about building a mine, then you might be able to estimate the number of people in the vicinity that could be affected by this action. It's much harder in the DNS when dealing with the DNS. It's much more harder to tease that out. Is it 10,000? Is it 100,000? Is it one? So that was something that was a really big challenge, and that's one element of impact assessments that remains a challenge. However, the second half of impact assessment is almost like a gap analysis of internal policies. It's kind of a review to see where the holes are. And one of the holes that we identified was that SIDN hadn't included transparency reporting in its annual report. Transparency report about the number of requests for data that come in or the number of takedown requests that they receive. So that was something that I wish that Martin could have joined us, Martin from SIDN, but he had a scheduling conflict. But that was something that they really, I think that they appreciated and they intend to implement was this kind of transparency reporting. So the two sides of an HRIA would be analyzing impact, but then also analyzing policy gaps. So analyzing policy gaps will be easier. In some scenarios, if you look at the ASO, which maybe doesn't have quite so defined a policy, then a policy development process, it might be harder to identify the gaps. But the hardest thing will be trying to assess the range of impact and the degree of impact on human rights and ultimately on humans. Yes, David.
Yeah. Thank you, Colin. I'd like to make two comments and then ask a question. The two comments are, first, with respect to the Ruge principles, I think I want to just strike a note of caution, and it's a note of caution. If Niels is still on the line, he'll recognize what I'm about to say, and that is we need to keep in mind that the Ruge principles, in my opinion at least, are subsidiary to the ICANN bylaw in the ICANN context, and I think that's important. The Ruge principles do great things, but among the comments are, I use two as an example. One comment is they talk about a string of business relationships that someone may have influence on. And it's a broad definition. It's not what lawyers call privity of contract or people who are in direct line of contract. It's much broader than that. And the other thing that the Ruge notes say is if you have leverage to enable human rights, you should use it. So in the ICANN context, that means to a registry or registrar to go down to the registrant level, and that conceivably pulls in content. That's something we have to be very careful about. And so that note of caution that I've sounded in the working group, I will continue to sound. The second comment I have is about Vidushi. I just want to say thanks to Vidushi because she's held the pen on this document that's called, I forget the name, but it's about human rights impact assessments in the PDP process. And so hats off to her. I do have some questions, and so my question to Vidushi is, where does that document stand? We did discuss it in Abu Dhabi, and frankly, I still had some remaining comments. I'll illustrate them this way. It addressed dealing with people who are vulnerable and potentially vulnerable. Well, to me, the idea of people who are potentially vulnerable is everybody in the world. And so I thought it was just a little bit broad. And the other thing that the document talked about in the PDP process was identifying, if I'm not mistaken, a dispute resolution mechanism. And it sounded to me in that document like it was within some kind of a PDP process. So those were my questions. I don't need those to be answered now. I'm simply saying if Vidushi could bring us up to speed as where the document is now and what opportunity we'll have for further input. Thank you very much.
I can just to respond briefly on your first point, I think that we are in total agreement regarding the bylaws, and that the bylaws are fundamentally, the bylaws are guiding everything, not only everything that's going to be done in this working group, but everything that ICANN does. So that is at the core of the question is how should the bylaws be interpreted? I think that we introduced the Ruge principles as a potentially helpful framework to supporting that interpretation and to guiding that interpretation, and that's it. Certainly not to say that we should be guided by the Ruge principles to the detriment or to be conflicting with the bylaw. And certainly, you know, the last thing that I think that anybody here wants is to be pushing into content regulation, which obviously is the third rail that we hear every meeting we need to stay away from, and I think that that's probably a value that everybody shares. Did you want to?
I think maybe we can let Vidushi answer the question.
Yeah, thanks, Colin, and thanks, David, for that very, very important question. I think the thinking behind the model was that we didn't want to be premature and say that this is the solution. Rather, we wanted to create a space for
Hey, Vidushi, could you speak just a little bit more slowly? Because we're not hearing you very well.
I'm going to speak a little more slowly. So I was saying thank you to David for that very important question. And just to, I think to answer your question, I will have to talk about what the model that was presented at the last meeting was intending to do. It was meant to be an initial sketch, an initial idea of how we could integrate human rights into policy development at ICANN. It wasn't supposed to be a concrete, really fleshed out model, simply because we wanted to create a space for disagreement and discussion around what that should look like. Having said that, I do agree with you that some of the terminology in the document as it stands right now is broad. And again, the thinking behind that was that we could refine it through discussion. So, for example, when we say vulnerable community, at the moment, in initial issue reports and in final issue reports during PDP, I very rarely come across a consideration that even has that sort of title, or even something that dips towards that sort of title, right? And what we were trying to really bring out there was the need to have an explicit reference or an explicit consideration of these particular problems. So, for example, if we have a particular section that looks at, okay, how is this human right compliant or not? And then we say, okay, how did it address vulnerable persons? How did it address the issue of diversity? How does it impact freedom of expression? That could also distill a lot of what the reports are actually trying to get at. I realize this is part of a longer conversation, but I can stop there and happy to take any follow-up questions, and thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, please, David.
I just want to say, Vidushi, thanks for all the work you're doing on this. I look forward to the next iteration, and I'll comment. Thank you.
Kathy, please.
Thanks, David.
And I had a question for you, Colin. You said something very quickly that I wanted to make sure I understood. So you're working with SIDN, which is .nl, right, the Netherlands. And you said that there were two things they weren't tracking, and I didn't catch the second one. One was takedowns, and the other one, based on your review, that they weren't tracking, that they should be tracking, was what?
They were tracking it. It was requests for data.
Thank you.
So they were tracking it. They have records of all of these things, but it wasn't something that they were including in any kind of transparency reporting.
So that would be like requests for the who is, kind of the equivalent of who is data and
exactly.
Things like that. Thank you.
So, and thanks very much, Vidushi, for that comment. The only thing that I might add is that in terms of resources, time, and energy, we as a team really have, instead of trying to progress on the HRIA model for ICANN, we did use SIDN and our collaboration with them as a kind of testbed of how to make the kind of language that you were saying is quite broad, David, and rightly so. We were using this as a bit of a testbed to try to make that more precise. And then, like I said, we're hoping that these kinds of lessons learned will be able to feed back into this process and inform the conversation that results in multi-stakeholder input into this model. Because I don't think that it's going to work if we unilaterally bring the solution to the table. It's much less likely to be received than if everybody works on it together and we come up with something that's a consensus document. So I'd like to pass it back to Vidushi actually now, because she's going to make a brief presentation about ongoing research that she's doing about the human rights impacts of specific PDPs. Vidushi?
Hi, Colin. Thank you. Can you hear me? I was having some trouble with my line. Are you able to hear me now?
We can hear you. Thank you.
Super. So thanks again. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm sorry that I can't join you all in Puerto Rico. Our presentation actually follows really nicely from the conversations that we've had so far. So while so far we have focused on dedicated spaces and professors for human rights, I think it is also important to take a step back and to question and study the human rights implications of ongoing policy development processes so that we can imbibe these concerns into day-to-day functioning at ICANN. And this is also part of our thinking to make human rights more systemic and organic to existing systems at ICANN. And like I was saying earlier, to have it baked into processes as opposed to have it be a retrospective consideration. So if we move to, actually, I'm not sure which slide you're on, but there's a slide where I've listed out all the existing policy development processes at the GNSO. And if you notice, I have color-coded them. So the ones in red are at the stage of board vote. The ones in yellow are at the implementation stage, and the ones in green are at the working group stage. So at this point, I'd just like to share some initial findings and research analysis on the way that these particular policy development processes are progressing. And I'd invite participants and leadership from these CDPs. I'm not exactly sure who's in the room. I do know Kathy and David are in the room, which makes me very happy. I would invite active participation in the PDPs to engage with this research and give us feedback on what areas we can work together and in what ways we can make the research more actionable for the actual working groups. So the first PDP that I'd like to talk to you about is the PDP to review all rights protection mechanisms in all GTLDs. That's on the next slide. And the charter of this particular PDP asks a very simple question. Do new rights protection mechanisms collectively fulfill the purpose for which they are created? And that is, of course, the new GTLDs. And the purpose for which they're created is to provide trademark holders with preventative or curative petitions against cyber squatting and other abuses of their legally recognized trademarks. And so I just want to walk you through a few of the learnings that I have come across in my research and trying to understand where this PDP is and some of the human rights concerns that arise out of it. So the first is when it comes to balancing the rights of applicants and other internet users, more specifically in the creation and unlockment of general top-level domains. So, generic top-level domains, sorry. So, as you can imagine, deciding who is the owner of a particular domain is always difficult. But what I found in the research so far is that the standards and the tests that are applicable to deciding who is or isn't the rightful owner is a bit problematic. So, for example, if you look back at the .Africa case, right? So .Connect Africa applied for this name. It was disqualified by ICANN in 2013 on questionable grounds because when an independent review was carried out, it was found that ICANN had some amount of problematic procedure in terms of how it upheld its own bylaws, how it preferred a certain bidder, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I do realize that is a single case, but I think that the important learning from that particular case is that we need more well-fleshed-out examples of... sorry, I just got feedback that you can't hear me well. Okay, I'm going to speak even slower. So I think what the .Africa case teaches us is that we need better standards for what constitutes a fair procedure for allotment of GTLDs. And so far, that hasn't been meaningfully refined, which I'd like to just point out at this time. The second is the trademark clearinghouse. Well, for those of you
Fiducci. Okay, I'm being asked to call a quick timeout by Kathy Kleiman, who's actually the co-chair of the RPM PDP. Kathy, would you like to step in?
Yeah. Okay. Vidushi, this is Kathy. You're raising very important issues. But the first and the last point, if I understand what the last point means, and I'll read them out loud, are not part of this working group. Creation and allotment of new GTLDs, e.g., GCC, I don't even know what that is, .Africa, .Islam. And the last one, a GTLD objection procedure, which I assume are the community objections and the rights objections and the string objections. I'm not sure that's what you mean, but if that's what you mean, this is outside the scope of the RPM working group, which only deals in second levels. So your other points apply. But we only deal in the second level. I think you might be interested in the subsequent procedures working group on these other two points. We're only at the second level. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. That's actually a really important point, and I was going to bring that towards the end. So I will discuss subsequent procedures as well. The idea behind talking about this under this particular section is that in the initial issue report, these are questions that I had reading the reports, right? Because either the framing was such that this did come under this particular PDP, and so this is the kind of engagement that I was really hoping for. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm happy to discuss why I did think it was relevant to have this under this section, but maybe we can save that for the end after you've heard my analysis on the subsequent procedures. Does that sound okay?
Sure, she says.
Okay, thank you. So the second issue is the trademark clearinghouse, which is essentially a mechanism that provides rights holders with special privileges to prevent registration of domain names that contain their trademark in any form. Right? So registration in this particular clearinghouse also gives access to sunrise periods, which means you have a priority access to trademark claims. You have, you know, sort of like a priority lane, if you will. So while this is in line, some would say, with the mission of this group, I think what we do need to take a step back and think about is how this is consistent with international intellectual property and trademark laws internationally. So, for example, the trademark protection is usually afforded within a class of goods and services and not in a blanket fashion as the trademark clearinghouse has. Secondly, there's usually fair use provisions that is embedded in trademark law, but that isn't the case again in the clearinghouse. And this clearly has, you know, a lot of implications for freedom of expression and also for digital fairness, freedom of expression of people who want to use generic words and, you know, proper names without malicious or fraudulent intent. It also hinders criticism of trademark owners, which again is very detrimental to freedom of expression. The third point that I wanted to talk about was ineligible or prohibited words. So while ICANN has often historically maintained that content-related decisions and discussions are outside the mandate, we have examples like, you know, the Olympic and Red Cross where there was a decision on content made within ICANN, which is also detrimental to the freedom of expression. And the last bullet point about a GTLD objection to figures, Kathy, you're right, I was going to talk about community objections, but keeping in mind your point, I think what I can do is I can talk about this at the level of the second PDP, which is that of subsequent procedures. So moving on to the second PDP on subsequent procedures, can I ask you to please move to that particular slide?
It's up.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this PDP looks at whether changes or adjustments to existing policy recommendations need to be changed, whether they need to be amended or overridden, and whether they need to be supplemented with new with new implementation guidance, right? And so the first issue that I've identified there, as you can see, is content-based GTLD system evaluations, which is very similar to the last point that I made with respect to ICANN moving into content regulation. There are a great number of people thinking and writing about this issue now, and I think at the point at of a PDP working group, what we need to ask ourselves is where does this drift occur and how, what policies or procedures do we have that let this happen and maybe, you know, reconfigure them to keep us within the mandate that ICANN had originally envisioned for itself. The problem with content-based string evaluations was, you know, first expressed when ICANN, I think in 2011 in the GATT communique, and then the Council of Report that Colin mentioned right at the beginning also talks about this. Then we have community trademark and public interest obligations to GTLD strings. And so over here, I think what is concerning is because over here what is concerning is that the definition of what is a significant objection from the community, that entire sentence is quite loaded, and we don't have clear definitions for it. I was following the subsequent procedures working group day before yesterday, and I'm really pleased to see that this is a point of a lot of discussion in the group, where we're thinking about whether, you know, the word community should be defined, whether we need a different standard. If we're going to define it, what would that look like? And I think this is really important, because usually when we think about community objections, community is usually used by applicants who already have some amount of standing, so this tends to entrench industry interests, and it marginalizes individual members without a clear definition of why and when that occurs. So that's another really important consideration and issue that I think needs deeper work, and it's great that it's already beginning to happen. Already happening. And following from this is the extent of reservation rights granted to IGOs. So as the present framework stands, we have special rights granted to non-governmental and intergovernmental organizations. And while this is, of course, important, again, the question of how narrow or how wide those privileges should be and how they're configured now has come into question. There's also a possibility that GTLD could result in easier censorship by governments. And I do expect a lot of pushback on this. But just to share what I'm thinking on this particular point. So there is a possibility that GTLD could result in easier censorship. So, for example, the Chinese government had made a proposal for a law which would allow only dominions registered in China to be accessed within the country and for all others to be automatically blocked, right? And it's not like global censorship and seizure of international domain names only happens in one area of the world. It also happens, you know, to United States government bodies. So if we take the Immigration and Customs Enforcement body, there's a lot of censorship that occurs on the grounds of internet counterfeit trafficking and piracy. So while domain names are disabled through the transfer of control of the domain by the registrars, efforts for greater control through filtering of domain names have been proposed by various states. And using the DNS for control of intellectual property is already a tenuous relationship. But when you look at it in terms of how governments could use existing policies and procedures, that's another, I would say, food for thought. So the second point on procedural fairness is something that I've already sort of discussed as we used to see the trademark clearing houses there. I don't want to repeat myself because I've already talked about the problems that arise out of that. And if we look at diversity and access, so there's a lot of inequity in how new GTLDs are allotted, right? So to give you an example, as of 2017, there were 1,930 applicants for new GTLDs. Out of this, 1,586 are from Europe and the U.S. here alone. And there is a problem, of course, because the cost of a new GTLD is around $185,000, which may, of course, be a significant deterrent. And I think we need, while there are mechanisms to help applicants with this, they aren't as meaningful as we'd like them to be because not much support has been given. So, for example, the applicant support directory is created by ICANN. It allows for financially needy GTLD applicants to seek financial and technical assistance. And ICANN has also set aside a certain amount for assisting such applications. But how many times such assistance has been given is also a big question mark, because as far as my research shows me, I think there's at best one case, and I'm sure that we also need to do better. And finally, you know, there are concerns with the first-come, first-served policies of the nature of which GTLDs are allotted. So this, again, it entrenches vested interests, it entrenches the haves and kind of isolates the have-nots. And maybe when we're thinking about how these procedures need to be adopted, we could also think about something that is more equitable, that is that, you know, opens the doors more in a more welcoming fashion. So if we can go to the next slide on registration and data services. So this has by far been the hardest PDP to study, A, because it's drowning in a lot of paperwork, at least 1,000 or 2,000 pages of which I've been trying to get through. But I think what I would definitely like to share about this particular PDP is that it has a lot of grounding in international data protection law. So, for example, some of the questions that are put up there is like users and purposes, and this is from the charter and from the final issue report, which is, you know, what kind of data should be processed and what who can decide what purposes that data should be processed for. The second question is who can access this data. The third is, you know, how do we ensure that there's accuracy of this data and so on. I think a lot of this is found in international data protection law. For example, we have purpose limitation. You know, we have principles that tell us that only those people who have been in their particular national jurisdictions accredited to need access to certain data, say, for example, law enforcement, should be given access to this data. And I think what's really interesting about this is many ICANN policies and procedures, you know, have a tendency to create accreditation schemes of their own or make it a much more ad hoc problem, whereas that is not only expensive, but it's also more practical. And so I'd love to hear from anyone in the room who is active in the CDP as to what the thinking is between ICANN policies versus international data protection, which is more well fleshed out. It's a shared framework with a great amount of understanding. But I just want to flag these issues. I think you can't hear me. Colin, I can stop here and begin a question.
Okay, do we have any questions? Unfortunately, we've lost Kathy, but do we have any questions from anyone in the audience about this ongoing research? Yes, David.
Thanks. My question, I just didn't understand. I think maybe Vidushi mentioned it, but where is the research? In other words, what's happening as a result of the research? I saw Kathy took notes for the RPM group. Is this just pure research in the background?
I think the thinking behind this is to actually work with CDC leadership and try and figure out what is useful for them. So it's a pretty catty left. We've only just started this. It's been an exercise for the past couple of months. But if you had ideas on how to make this more actionable or if there was a way in which we could participate in the PDPs as a CCWP, that would be very useful. Thank you.
Thank you, Vidushi. I just need to give it some thought. I don't have anything to say about it right now, but thank you very much.
So if I can give my personal opinion of the articulation here, I think that it's really valuable to continue assessing. Here, actually, if we could skip down. This is the future research, so I'll... I think that it's really valuable as a part of ongoing due diligence to continue exploring ICANN's effects on human rights in a more research and academic scenario. And if the gentleman from Sweden has any ideas about how we can research particular rights, like those relating to the child, for example, if you or your colleagues or your partners would like to work with the CCWP to flesh that out a bit more and kind of decipher what may or may not be within the ICANN community or the ICANN mission, that's definitely something we would welcome. But then this kind of research and exploration into the application or the effects of ICANN policies on human rights really goes hand in hand with the work to develop tools and frameworks and mechanisms for living up to the bylaw. So the way that I see it, first, if we don't know which rights are potentially impacted, then it's very hard to develop a tool for measuring those impacts more systematically. So I think that this is all research. It will feed back into the PDP only perhaps in the form of comments, public comments, for example. But at this stage, this is very much exploration, research, and then going hand in hand with the ongoing research to develop human rights impact assessment tools. Would you like to speak to future research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be good to use that last discussion to springboard into finding an avenue forward. And specifically to look into what the community suggestions are for how to make the best use of this working party and what areas of research and investigation would be most useful in order to support implementation of the bylaw and support the ongoing challenges that the community is going to face with regard to human rights going forward. Are there any questions or comments on research that you think would be helpful?
Okay, yeah, like we said, these are a couple ideas that we had come up with about tracking decision-making processes and then effectiveness of remedy. Like I said, this is an ongoing effort. But do we have any other business from our participants here? No? Okay, well then I think that it's time for us to wrap up. I can see that maybe people are itching to go to the impromptu GDPR session, which was unfortunately scheduled right at this time, because this is something that obviously has an impact on human rights. So I would just encourage you to visit our website, to track our work, to get to subscribe to the mailing list. I would like to get your contact information, and let's keep the conversation going, especially ahead of the next meeting in Panama and the various calls that we will have in between, and then the forthcoming implementation of the human rights bylaw, which will be a fun and exciting time for us here at the Cross-Community Working Party. Mike, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just in terms of avenues forward, I think that it's great to see such good turnout that we got, at least for the first hour before people started to trickle out. It's great to get so much turnout, and it's particularly good to see people from different communities and different stakeholder groups coming out and engaging. Fundamentally, what we're hoping to do is to use this forum as a space for collaborative research and engagement in developing these human rights avenues forward. So we hope that you will all stay engaged with our work going forward, including in between the ICANN meetings when we're going to be having regular calls to discuss the research that we're carrying out, hopefully to get more, ideally volunteers to take some of this stuff forward, but at the very least to offer your opinions and insights, which are very valuable and which will help us to proceed forward in a proper multi-stakeholder fashion. So thanks very much to everybody for coming out, and we'll look forward to connecting with the rest of you on the list. And join our list if you're not on it, please. Also that.